Hello, and welcome to a podcast from the Ark Street Forums, which are hosted by the Ark Street United Methodist Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Tonight's forum, on October 7th, 2015, is titled Myths of Discovery, Rethinking the Meaning of Columbus Day. This is the first of three forums dedicated to the theme of American myths. A second forum in January will consider America's racial myths. The third forum, to be held in April, will take a critical look at the myth that the U.S. was founded as a Christian nation. Tonight's forum includes two 20-minute presentations and a time for discussion. The first presenter is Reverend Dr. John Norwood. Reverend Norwood is the founding pastor of the Ojima Village Christian Church near Trenton, New Jersey, and a leader in the Nanticoke Lenni Lenape Tribal Nation. He's also the General Secretary for the Alliance of Colonial Era Tribes, Government Liaison for the Confederation of Sovereign Nanticoke Lenape Tribes, and co-chair of the Task Force on the Federal Acknowledgement of the National Congress of American Indians. The second speaker is Dr. David M. Kruger. That's me. I'm an independent scholar of religion, history, and American culture. I'm also the author of the new book, Myths of the Runestone, Viking Martyrs and the Birthplace of America, published by the University of Minnesota Press. I'm also a deacon serving at Ark Street United Methodist Church, so without further ado, I'll turn the microphone over to Reverend Norwood. I hope you enjoy the recording of tonight's forum. Be sure to listen to the end to hear a special word from Ark Street's pastor, Reverend Robin Heinecke.
I want to thank Reverend David for inviting me to come this evening, and for Pastor Robin for his warm welcome. I praise God for my wife, who is forever at my side and to whom I am greatly indebted. She, too, is involved in tribal leadership. She is the supervisor for our tribal youth council, trying to raise up our young people to continue the tribal government and to maintain the cohesiveness of our people. And I have some friends here from among the Quakers who are forever at our side, fighting alongside of us in a relationship that goes back at least to the 1600s, and we're grateful for that. Tonight, I'm here to talk a little bit about Columbus, and I got detoured, took a wrong turn, and ironically wound up on Columbus Street, you know? And I said to my wife, I said, Tanya, isn't it ironic that I'm on this street that they changed from Delaware Avenue, which is what the English called my people, the Lenape, and here we are wandering, lost on Columbus Avenue, and based upon the way folks tell the story, it seems today, we were lost here on this continent, didn't even know we were here until Columbus came and told us where we were. But one of the things that always impressed me is the way that people can attach themselves to myths that are filled with lies and hold them so dear that even upon a reevaluation of the facts, they are so emotionally tied to a lie that actually perpetuates suffering and celebrates wickedness, that they will attack the people that are trying to right the wrong. So I want to talk a little bit about that this evening. As a call for compassionate and faithful reflection. There's some quotes in here, both by Columbus and also by those that knew him and were along with him. The Indians are so naive and so free with their possessions that no one who has not witnessed them would believe it. When you ask for something they have, they never say no. To the contrary, they offer to share with anyone. Now, while he was speaking specifically about those that were living in the Caribbean, that is a true statement for most of the nations that are across North America. Certainly it was for us and many of the Easterners, those are the people of the dawn where the sun rises. It was important that we practiced hospitality. And part of that was if someone asked you for something, you gave it to them. Because the Creator would always provide more. Well, that kind of got us in trouble. Because if you see the next part of the statement, they would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. Now, the National Council of Churches of Christ in the USA made a statement, I believe this was in 1990, and they were discussing the issue about Columbus and the celebration of Columbus Day, and they talked about the things that were attached to that history, the reality of that history, not what's popularly celebrated, not when the kids learn the songs in school and reenact the landing of Columbus in the Americas, but they went right to the core of it and they lifted up words like slavery, genocide, theft, exploitation. They acknowledged the fact that the people who were indigenous to these lands have been ridden over by this myth. Not only did they suffer during the era of discovery and conquest, but also continue to suffer in many ways today. We hold some myths to be self-evident. The first myth, if you grow up here in the United States, post about 1930, when Columbus Day became a big deal, you are told and celebrate and you're rehearsed, Columbus discovered America. Columbus discovered America. There's no qualifier on it. Not that he discovered it for Spain, not that he discovered it for Europe, which in and of itself would be inaccurate. Not that he discovered it just for himself, that he wound up here and it was a new thing to him, but that he discovered it. And that means that all of the indigenous people who were already here are discovered people. That is a politically charged statement that we'll talk about by the time we get to the end of this. And I'm going to be moving kind of quickly because I could talk about this all day, but I've been told I'm not allowed to. So that is the first part of a lie. He did not discover him. You can't discover. If I discovered the Ark Street United Methodist Church this evening, I discovered it. I'm claiming it. I'm claiming it for the Nanticoke Lenni Lenape Tribal Nation. I didn't bring a flag, but I have a hanky. And if I throw my hanky down here on the floor or wave it up in the air and claim this is mine, I'm not only going to take control of this building and the land that it's on, but everybody in it. And you're going to start doing exactly what I tell you to do. And if you don't do exactly what I tell you to do, I'm going to do some awful things to you. Matter of fact, I'm going to tell you that God wants you to do exactly what I tell you to do and has subjugated you to me because I have some information about him that you don't have, and I'm going to make you believe in it as I enslave you and take your lands from you and teach you how to be more like me so that you can be civilized. That is the story of Columbus. And that is the story that so many young people today aren't getting in the schools, and the story that is being denied by so much of America. The next story is that Columbus is a great hero, that his name is sacred, that his statues are everywhere, and anyone who does anything against any of those statues, it's like spitting on the flag. And to question his legacy and to question the facts around this time of discovery is to be somehow unpatriotic and un-American. The third myth actually is what allows the first to exist. And that is that American Indians are just too sensitive. We are too upset about the history here in the United States. We're far too sensitive about the things that we're currently going through and continue to go through. We just need to get over it. And besides, we really don't count anyway. And we don't count because we were already here and yet this land had to be discovered. We don't count because that discovery gave the right to some other folk to claim the land, whether we wanted to give it away or not. We don't count. We don't count. We don't even count in the founding documents of this nation. You take a read of the Declaration of Independence. Find where it talks about Indians and what it has to say. You'd be shocked. That's another lecture. All right, now there's the perspective that what we do when we celebrate Columbus Day and we celebrate the memory of Columbus is that we are celebrating this discovery, this expansion into the new world, and what we don't realize is that our language itself is oppressive. To say discovery when it is associated with Columbus or anyone that is not indigenous is to deny the humanity of the indigenous people. If you're discovered somewhere, that means that you didn't uncover it to begin with. It only counts when someone else comes and claims it and says, oh, it's there. There's a joke that we say, and we call it Indian country. That's wherever Indians get together around here. One of the jokes is, if there's an Indian walking in the wood and a white man doesn't see him, was he there? Among American Indians, Columbus represents a memory of pain and of loss. Not victory, not celebration, not ingenuity, not bravery. While many still celebrate Columbus as a hero, the indigenous people have little joy in the commemoration of his arrival and the results that followed. Do I celebrate Columbus Day? I don't know. the Jews celebrate Hitler's birthday. Mm-hmm. Susan Harjo, who at one point in her life was the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians and now works for an activist organization, observed that Native American people in this red quarter of Mother Earth have no reason to celebrate an invasion. Very different word, isn't it, from discovery. An invasion that caused the demise of so many of our people and is still causing destruction to this day. You can find this on a whole lot of shirts. This is Homeland Security, Fighting Terrorism Since 1492. Columbus himself, these are his words, because a lot of people say, oh, this is the revisionist history that these ultra-liberals are doing, undermining patriotism and the Christian nation, as you made reference to before. Anytime you try to bring the accurate history to someone who is embracing the myth, right or wrong, they will call what you're doing revisionism, when actually it's just correcting. From Columbus, from his own words, as soon as I arrived in the Indies, in the first island which I found, I took some of the natives by force in order that they might learn and might give me information of whatever there is in these parts. He is talking about resources, specifically gold, which is really what he was here looking for. If you can imagine the Twin Towers and the smoke, these are two teepees. I'll make the correction. There were no teepee people in this area. My ancestors weren't teepee people. But that is a symbol of the American Indian that many people are familiar with. When Americans in this era think about 9/11, we get emotional about the destruction. And rightly so. Rightly so. But for whatever reason, so many Americans cannot relate to the pain and the loss of 100 million indigenous people in the Americas from the point of contact through to the colonial era. 90% of my own people, the Lenape and the Nanako people, nine out of every 10 died. So many died from disease and from violent interaction that there weren't enough left to bury the dead. Mm-hmm. Most Americans don't know that American Indians and Alaskan Natives, among our youth, we have the highest risk of committing suicide, the highest rates of diabetes. And I take nothing away from Black Lives Matter. Certainly, Black lives do matter. Absolutely. But one of the facts that's absolutely ignored is that per capita, percentage-wise, American Indians are killed by the authorities at a higher rate than any other racial group in the United States. You just never hear about it. And by the way, that's not my statistic. That was a statistic from the National Institutes of Health. In 1500, Columbus wrote, 100 castellanos are as easily obtained for a woman as for a farm. What he's talking about here is that his men preferred child sex slavery and that he supported it. Their preference is looking for girls from about 9 to 10. They're the ones that are in demand now. So that the children of the indigenous population were turned into sex slaves and sold to those who had discovered the islands. He forced peaceful natives to work in his gold mines until they died of exhaustion, and if an Indian worker did not deliver his full quota of gold dust by Columbus's deadline, the soldier would cut off the man's hands and tie them around his neck to send a message. If you notice, if you look very carefully, the faces here, many of them look like they are skulls. It is because they've also had their noses cut off. When we talk about what happened in the West Indies, one of the writers, his name is Bartolome de las Casas, actually was an eyewitness to these things during the era when it was happening. His father actually had been with Columbus on one of his voyages, and he wound up in the Caribbean and observed these things himself, becoming a monk and recording a lot of the atrocities. For whatever reason, this is not taught in the schools and not associated with the name Columbus. He talks about the fact that in the name of Christians, these folks actually came with the purpose, not the public display was that we're going to Christianize. And there were some missionaries that actually, that was their intent. I'm not saying that everybody was like this. But we're talking about Columbus. He said in order that ultimately was about extirpation, getting rid of an extermination of the people far from the face of the earth. And they spared no age, no sex. Women with children, their children were ripped out of their bellies and slaughtered. This is his eyewitness from the period. He talks about how the men made a sport of beheading, dismembering, running the native men through, that they would take the parts of the dead and feed it to the dogs. They would actually unleash dogs on some of them and have the dogs tear them limb from limb. But when the Indians died, they actually, and there are illustrations of this, if you go online you can find them, they would actually sell their limbs as meat that would be served to the dogs, so the dogs would get a taste for flesh and would readily attack the natives if they were ordered to do so. Now, it's difficult to talk about Columbus without also talking about the context out of which he comes and the continuing impact of that era. The atrocities really are enough for us to rethink the celebration of Columbus, to rethink it completely, to rethink the words we use. Discover. That's a loaded word, and I'm going to tell you why. There is a doctrine that was perpetuated first within some papal bulls coming from the Roman Catholic Church that declared non-Christian lands to be able to be claimed by Christian monarchs. In the earliest ones that came out in the mid-15th century, Pope Nicholas issued two and essentially gave the King of Portugal the right to vanquish the enemies of Christendom, which was anybody who wasn't Roman Catholic at the time, put them in perpetual slavery. It's an interesting form of missiology, missions by slavery, and seize their possessions and property. That was the policy. Out of this comes the notion of the exploration of the planet. So all of those great explorers that we learn about are coming from this backdrop, either directly because their countries were Roman Catholic or indirectly because even if they were no longer Roman Catholic, the influence, the attitude was there and carries into the political structures from which they came. And Pope Alexander VI, who is a Spaniard, affirmed the Spanish title over the Americas by saying that they were newly discovered, principally because no European Christian had previously laid claim to the continents. So the answer to the question, if an Indian is walking in the woods and a white man doesn't see him, was he there? He is. Was the white man a European Christian, and was the Indian unbaptized? Because if that's the case, then no, he wasn't there. If, however, he was one of the good civilized Indians that had been declared okay by the Christian white man, then yes, he was in the woods, but he couldn't own the woods. The bulls that were issued in the late 1400s by Pope Alexander allowed the lands that were discovered to be claimed by these Christian monarchs, and he took it a little further, actually dividing the planet into some sections and granting the rights of discovery to Portugal and to Spain. Now, there were some other European powers that obviously wound up getting involved, the British and the French and the Dutch, but as they came with this cultural understanding. Even if they weren't following the edict of the bulls themselves, they came with this cultural understanding. And we know that to be the case because the most recent reference to the doctrine of discovery was not back in colonial times, legally here in the Americas. It wasn't during the early federal period. It wasn't even during the early part of the 1900s. It was about 2006, 2007 from the Supreme Court of the United States. The doctrine of discovery is the underpinning for American Indian law and policy. Supreme Court decisions that stand as the standard for these policies started way back at the inception of the United States and continue to be quoted in decisions and used as the basis for legislation to this very day. So when someone tells me to get over it, they don't have a clue. Because it's still happening. It's not a wound that an ancestor felt the generations from that point did not feel anymore. It's something my children and children's children are dealing with today. And as we scream about it, so few Americans are listening. There is a problem that goes back to that issue with how many Native American youth wind up being at risk of suicide, the highest risk of suicide. And it's reflective of also the fact that Native Americans are at the highest risk for alcoholism, drug abuse, diabetes, depression. And part of the reason, and this is currently being studied, it's similar to PTSD. The phenomenon has been studied. There were Jews that came out of the Holocaust, you know, and the next generation kind of experienced this, even though they may not have been there in the Holocaust. The trauma was passed from one generation to the next and then passed on. When we deal with folks that are coming out of battles, some of the veterans that are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere else, we're now understanding that there are some things that happen psychologically that actually shift the way they're able to live. Well, there are studies now that say that PTSD is something that actually crosses generations. That it's something that is passed. It's an intergenerational trauma that occurs based on the history of the people. And when those people are continuing to be subjugated by the same things, and the stories of pain and suffering from one generation are witnessed and experienced in the next generation, that trauma continues. So when I got lost today, and I drove down Columbus Avenue, I was angry. And maybe I am a little too sensitive about some things, but I think about this one, I may just simply be enlightened. And I thank God for those of you who feel likewise. I thank you for your attention. Could you just show that last slide, please? What you can't see is what they're saying to each other. These are two American Indians, and they're looking at Osama bin Laden on one hand, Columbus on the other. And they're confused as to how one can be deemed as a villain and a terrorist, and the other, who was responsible for many more deaths, and the continuation of suffering even today, is hailed as a national hero. I thank you.
Thank you, Reverend John Norwood. I'm Dave Kruger. I'm an independent scholar of religion and American history, studied at Temple University, and my area of research is looking at American myths and those narratives and stories that bind us together as Americans. I'll begin by talking a little bit about the history of the movement to challenge Columbus Day. And then I'll move back even further in history to give you a bit of a synopsis of how Columbus rose into this revered American figure that we've come to know him today. It was 1992 in San Francisco, California. 1992, as you probably figured out, was the 500th anniversary of Columbus arriving in the Bahamas. This was a very special celebration, because San Francisco was the first city in the United States to recognize Columbus Day as a civic holiday, way back in 1869. For the event, they planned to have Columbus, a Columbus figure, sail in on a ship from the bay, and he was to arrive on the shore of the city and participate in the annual parade that had been going on for over 100 years. But the ship was not able to get close to shore, because between Columbus and the shore was an armada. They called it the Peace Navy, actually, at the time. It was a group of about 4,000 people in boats and canoes and kayaks and rafts, blocking the path of Columbus. So as the ship sailed up, Columbus took a look at what was going on and decided, you know what, I think I'm going to head back the other way. And he never got off the ship at that location. This event really marks in American history the beginnings of a coalescing of a movement to challenge Columbus Day celebrations. Berkeley, California was the first city to no longer recognize Columbus Day as a civic holiday. And the status today is basically this. South Dakota state recognizes Native American Day. Hawaii celebrates Discovery Day, and it's not European discovery, but they actually celebrate Polynesian discovery. Several cities across the country have successfully renamed Columbus Day Indigenous Peoples Day, including Seattle last year, Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I'm from, and St. Paul, Minnesota. So there's a growing movement in several other cities as well. What we'll talk about now is the history of how Columbus got to be celebrated as the figure that he is today. The moral crimes of Columbus are clearly laid out for us, and we've known them for a long time, haven't we? Howard Zinn wrote a book back in 1980 called The People's History of the United States. That book has been around for a long time, and that detailed and popularized a kind of a revisionist form of history, which is, in actuality, a correction of misinformation in history. These atrocities of Columbus have been known for a long time. And it's also interesting that Columbus is celebrated because Columbus never reached what is now the United States. Other European explorers, if you're interested in Europeans, folks like John Cabot and Hernando de Soto, they touched other parts of what is now the United States, but Columbus is the figure that is revered. And I think that has to do with an American agenda early on that, being that Columbus didn't quite touch what is now the United States, he didn't really have a Spanish claim, therefore the British claim could be more accepted. That's perhaps why other explorers have not been lifted up like Columbus. Columbus really began to emerge as an American symbolic figure very, very early. The first widespread embrace of Columbus came in 1776 by a poet named Phyllis Wheatley. Phyllis Wheatley wrote a poem addressed to General George Washington in 1776. She put forth this notion of a goddess figure called Columbia, the goddess Columbia. Her aim was to inspire General Washington in the fight in the revolutionary cause. It might be kind of strange to our imaginations today to think of nations embodied by these goddess-type figures, but at the time, Great Britain was embodied by Britannia. France had her own goddess figure. So Americans drew upon this new Columbia figure to inspire a growing sense of a nation, of a new nation that was being born. And this personification of the United States was prolific throughout the 19th century. You saw her everywhere, and that's why you will see the name Columbia in a lot of landmarks in the U.S. today. The District of Columbia, Columbia, South Carolina, Columbia University, Columbia Films. You watch a movie, you see the opening credits, you see the goddess statue. That is Columbia, a feminized representation of Christopher Columbus. Her popularity began to wane in the First World War, and Uncle Sam emerged as a more popular figure, but this figure is deeply embedded in American culture. Another aspect of Columbus, I would even call it deification, or the apotheosis, or the making divine of Columbus, happened through a biography written by Washington Irving. He wrote Sleepy Hollow, Rip Van Winkle. In 1828, he wrote a biography of Christopher Columbus. The biography was titled The Life and Voyages of Christopher Columbus. As Washington Irving wrote about Columbus, he recreated him with a new brand, so to speak. He was the quintessential self-made man, the individual who could stand against great odds. He was the person with great vision. He was a pioneer. These are all the types of descriptors that Irving uses to describe Columbus. Now, why would this be so appealing in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s in American history? Because this was the time of westward expansion. This is the time of the frontier spirit, of the noble, courageous white individual heading out into the mysterious savage wilderness to create his own destiny. Washington Irving's portrait of Columbus was deeply, deeply appealing and resonated with an emerging dominant spirit among white Americans in the 19th century. And of course, Irving also made Columbus into an innocent figure. It wasn't Columbus himself who committed these crimes. It was those who came after him. It was the greedy king and queen of Spain. It was their fault. But Columbus,
was a visionary figure that should be embraced as a national moral exemplar. These two cultural sources, the Columbia figure, the Washington Irving's Columbus, were so persuasive that Americans started to build monuments to Christopher Columbus. The first monument was in Baltimore, 1792. The second was in the District of Columbia in 1817. And things really began to pick up pace in the 1860s. There's a website online that's a list of every Columbus statue in the world. And there must be several hundred. It picked up pace in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, 90s in particular, around the 400th anniversary of Columbus. And even here in Philadelphia, the very first Columbus statue was erected, as I understand it, in Fairmount Park, erected in 1876, but it was moved finally to South Philly, Broad in Oregon. And even much more recently, we have a statue on what was Delaware Avenue. We have the Columbus Monument. And the website that tells the story of that monument says the following: just as William Penn was influenced by biblical teaching, so was Christopher Columbus. A lot of Quakers here in the room tonight. I think we all know that William Penn had a much different way of interacting with Native people than did Christopher Columbus. All right, so Columbus as this American, this embodiment of the nation state. At what point did Columbus become this ethnic figure that we hear about? Irish and Italian Catholics started promoting Columbus and building statues in the 1860s. Both groups tapped into his symbolic power as America's founder. Italian and Irish Catholics knew that Columbus was a powerful American figure. But these new immigrants to the United States said, wait, I don't think Americans are realizing that this guy was Catholic. As Philadelphia history indicates, Catholics were persecuted greatly during the Bible riots of the 1840s. Catholic churches were burned down in this city. So these vulnerable immigrants turned towards Columbus as a figure of inspiration. If the white dominant Americans revered him, we're going to tap into that power by reminding Americans that he was Catholic and also Italian. So the first state to recognize Columbus Day as an official holiday was Colorado in 1905. And at the time, many in the immigrant communities and even progressive liberal elites celebrated that as a triumph of multiculturalism. Finally, these vulnerable immigrants could be integrated into the American story by revering Columbus. This was a view as a step forward. And by 1934, the United States adopted Columbus Day as an official national holiday, inspired by immigrant motivations. And Columbus Day was always a very fragile thing in American society. It was not accepted by everyone. And there were folks who challenged the rise of Columbus, and it wasn't Native Americans in power challenging it. There were other white groups challenging it. For example, Joseph Smith found some golden plates, and he translated a story inscribed on those golden plates, and he said that it told the story of a lost tribe of Israel that had come to North America, integrating Mormons into this American narrative by saying that their people were here even earlier or at the same time as Natives, extending this kind of ancient history. The amateur archaeologist Caleb Atwater would go to a Native American burial ground in Ohio and say, well, this is far too architecturally complicated for Indians to have made this. So it must have been Egyptians or ancient Phoenicians that came 1,000 years ago that came to North America. So continually writing white fantasies and myths into the landscape and reinterpreting the folks that were already there through a white lens. And finally, tonight, my area of expertise is looking at how Americans have been fascinated by the notion that Vikings had beaten Columbus to North America, another way of challenging dominant narrative. Now, of course, we know that Viking explorers did end up settling in Newfoundland. We've known that since the 1960s. So having a European discoverer is really your thing. If that's really important to you, Leif Erikson was there before Columbus and maybe others. We now know that. But in the 19th century, people weren't sure that that was the case, but they wanted desperately to believe it to be so. There was a Norwegian immigrant named Rasmus Bjorn Andersen, a Norwegian who argued that Vikings had settled as far south as Rhode Island and Massachusetts. Massachusetts was the key place in Andersen's mind. He listed the Norse sagas as proof of that and argued that that Vinland was in Massachusetts. And he also argued that Leif Erikson's brother Thorvald was killed by Native Americans in the wilderness of Cape Cod in order to bring Christianity to the New World. So we already have a kind of a white martyrdom sacrifice type of story. What was Andersen trying to do with these myths? He's drawing on the Norse sagas for a specific purpose, and that was this. He wanted to integrate his new Norwegian immigrants into the American narrative by saying that they were the ones who were the founders. They were the ones who made the original sacrifice in founding the country, and they too were victimized by those savages that tried to kill the Christian faith. But it wasn't just Norwegians who liked Vikings. It was even those Boston elite New England historians. They loved Vikings because they were the uber whites. They were as white as you could possibly get. They were the embodiment of the Anglo-Saxon racial ideal. This was the time during the mid-19th century where you had new waves of immigration coming in. Catholics, Italians. You had folks who were labeled as not white. Italians and Irish at one point in American culture were not considered to be white. They were a racial other. So by these New England elites embracing Viking discovery myths, they were able to soothe some of their own anxieties and try to argue that America in its beginnings was truly a white place. And this figure here, I just want you to take a look at. This is a Viking statue here in Philadelphia. Does anybody know where this statue is today? That's right at the end of Boathouse Row. This is a Viking. His name is not Leif Erikson. His name is Thorfinn Karlsevni. Thorfinn was, in the sagas, believed to be the first European to settle North America and to give birth to his wife gave birth to a European child on American soil. And this Viking statue is very appealing to particular folks known as the Keystone State skinheads. In 2013, there was a white supremacist rally held right next to this statue. And I tried to listen to some of the video. It was very garbled because it was such a conflicted situation. But there was a lot of language of this being the first white American. Even neo-Nazis and skinheads are appealing today to this notion of a whiter past. And finally, my book talks about a Midwestern version of this myth, a belief that Viking explorers came to Minnesota in 1362 and died at the hands of Native Americans in what would one day become Minnesota. Many Nordic enthusiasts of this myth, and it wasn't just Scandinavians, it was also a broad cross-section of white Americans. Actually, at one point in 1960, 60% of Minnesotans believed that Vikings had come to Minnesota prior to Columbus, another challenge to the narrative. And this myth was a dysfunctional way of coming to terms with a violent past. The Dakota War of 1862, Dakota tribes had been relegated to a narrow, resource-deprived strip of land in southern Minnesota, and the U.S. government neglected to send the meager annuities that were due to them because this was the height of the American Civil War. And a conflict broke out. White settlers were killed. Within a few weeks, the U.S. Army had rounded up all the Dakota in southern Minnesota, a few thousand of them, sentenced many to death, and exiled thousands of them and sent them to resource-deprived reservations out in the Dakotas. And many Minnesotans were angry that more Dakota were not executed. And what I argue is that this myth of Vikings, the telling of the story scribed into a stone artifact that a Swedish farmer found in the field, begins to really indicate the level of ongoing anxiety and a desire to justify white conquest of Minnesota. Because if they could prove that Native Americans were savaged in 1362, they were just as savage in 1862, and therefore our conquest of Native Americans is fully justified.
In conclusion, myths of discovery are inherently political. These myths often serve to define who is a true American, who belongs, and who does not. Discovery myths also stake a claim. They assert power. They serve to justify domination and control. They perpetuate the notion that American history only begins when non-Indigenous persons show up, be they Vikings, Italians, Egyptians, or whatever. Reverend Norwood outlined tonight with great prophetic clarity the crimes of Columbus. No matter how important Columbus has been to Americans in the past, it is time to reconsider what he means for the present. If we are to be a people who seek justice and truth in the stories we tell about the past, it is time to bring an end to the celebration of Christopher Columbus. Thank you.
At this point, we invited the attendees to ask questions and offer comments. The first question was addressed to Reverend Dr. John Norwood. He was asked how his Christian faith informs his critique of Columbus Day.
Lifting him up as a Christian figure is an insult to my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And I think that it's important that Christians stand together over this issue. Because when Columbus came and planted the Spanish flag, he claimed this land not only for Spain, but for Jesus Christ. And that was not who he was representing. So I think it's important that we remind people of that. The other thing is that continuing to talk about discovery and to continue that, then there have been shows recently who really discovered America, and it always is the Vikings or the Egyptians or aliens or whatever. And it is so ironic because essentially whenever you ask that question, you're saying that I'm not human. That it doesn't matter that my people have been here. That we don't count, we're not human. Part of the way that Columbus was able to commit those atrocities and that people are not reviled by the activity is because in the subliminal text that we get, the message that we get in American history is that people of color don't matter. That's a fact. So the more that we fight against that, the more we try to correct the myth of discovery, the more we are coming in line with the intent of the Creator, in my view.
Anyone like to add something?
I just wanted to add that celebration that you were talking about the statue on Boathouse Row, it's going to happen this Saturday. It was found out that they're trying to keep it quiet, but it was found out that it's going to be this Saturday.
Okay, so the Keystone State skinheads are returning to the statue again. Okay, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Last summer, this church was visited by Apache Stronghold. The Apache Stronghold representatives represented their tribe, the San Carlos Apaches in Arizona. Their land was being confiscated by the United States. Well, actually, they don't control their own land, and it was being given to a copper company to mine and destroy. And the leader of that group was named Tupac, and he wrote something that is pertinent to this. It's that the Pope, while he was here, should rescind the doctrine of discovery, which was, of course, written by a previous two popes. And so I was going to give this to Reverend Norwood.
Thank you, sir.
They came back, but unfortunately, they were not able to speak to the Pope.
I was with him.
Oh.
We actually were hosted by the Quakers, both here at the Arch Street Meeting House around the corner and also at the Burlington Meeting House up in Burlington, New Jersey, which are historic meeting houses. And there were representatives from both North and South America in an intercontinental working group. And a statement was issued in regard to that. And I'm glad that word is getting around. Tupac is an interesting character. He is soft-spoken, but he carries a big stick. And I thank God for him. And thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
I have a question about, I guess, really about the history of Christianity, which, you know, I would think that Columbus would say he was a representative of Christianity. He was doing Jesus Christ's work. Certainly the popes thought he was. There's been a history of killing the other for a long, long time. Where do you think this comes from, and how does it relate to saying we should get rid of all the Muslims, you know, which is the right-wing Christians are saying that now?
Interestingly enough, the attitude in regard to Christianity being an earthly kingdom, which is exactly what Jesus denied when he was questioned in his own trial by Pontius Pilate. And Pilate asks, "So you're a king?" And Jesus says, "So you say I am, but my kingdom is not of this world." And yet, by the time Rome becomes a Christian empire, the concept of Christendom, the dominion, the domination of Christianity intertwined with state powers, confused the gospel. And the mythological Jesus is what became the symbol and the image of Christ vanquishing all of the enemies of the Christian kingdom here in this world. And people then had the concept that you could convert folks by forcing them to be baptized and giving them the choice, baptized, be baptized, or die. Well, obviously, if you read the Gospels, if you read the New Testament, it's very clear that's not how it works. But the link between the dominion of Rome and when Rome became Christian continues. And so the enemy of Rome was the Muslim that controlled the Holy Land. And really, it was more about the resources and the trade routes through the Holy Land. And so that's where the attack begins. It really wasn't a faith issue, because Christians, Jews, and Muslims got along great in the Middle East prior to this era. But at that point, there was this violence that took place. And what we see now is this being resuscitated. There are extremist Christians. Prior to 9/11, the greatest terrorist attack in the United States against other American citizens that weren't Native American was done by a guy who was white and claimed to be Christian. So, you know, Oklahoma City. So, if you can make the enemy as other as possible, and then group the enemy with some group, some alien group you want to get rid of, there's this tendency to divide that continues. But it is not Christian. It's not Christian. I have a friend who refers to the doctrine of discovery, and he calls it the Christian doctrine of discovery, and I always tell him it is not a Christian doctrine. It's a misuse of the term.
There are a couple of different directions we could go in the conversation. I think this the philosophical, the theological, and we've talked about historical. We could also talk a little bit about, if there's interest in the political, the viability, the possibility of us being a part of a movement and initiating a movement to persuade the city of Philadelphia to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day as an alternative to Columbus Day. So that, feel free if you'd like to comment on that as well. There is currently no petition that I've put together or anybody's put together for Philadelphia, but I would put that on the table as well. But feel free, are there more comments about anything you've heard tonight?
I think you've both said that people don't seem to change their attitudes when what they're getting is a lot of facts, a lot of information, that people's attitudes are not changing as a result of information. So what are the ways that attitudes can be changed?
There's a lot of veteran movement leader type folks in this room, so.
Well, the United Methodist Church has been trying for the last 4 years to reconcile, you know, our church with Native American past through the active reconciliation.
Act of repentance?
Repentance, yes. We haven't been very successful. As the leader of the Native American group in this church, which has been active for about 20 years, we've been trying to get other churches to do the same. You know, have a active monthly group which educates people about Native American culture, their history, and what Natives have gone through. And we also have a Native American Sunday, which we are going to have this coming November 15th. But we've not been very successful. We have a conference-level group called CONAM, which is going to, you know, conference-level workshops and trying to persuade other churches to do something to educate their people about Native Americans. And, you know, we get very few people even signing up for them. It's very frustrating.
Thank you. Tonight has been excellent for me to be present, and I'm really grateful that I was invited here by the Native American Awareness Group president, Dale, who just spoke a few moments ago. The question was asked, how can we change someone if we're not using facts? And what I've discovered is, of course, putting a human face on the issue. You know, there isn't anyone here who has watched CNN who does not remember seeing a little child face down in the water, and that changed lives. It changed what does a person running from persecution look like. It's a child. We just saw a hospital that was attacked. And yes, that's a human face. We all know what it's like to be in a hospital where we think we're going to be healed, and then there's an attack in which people are killed. So putting a human face, and I have to say this, that there are hidden American Indians all over, and some are in this room, and they're hidden because it wasn't safe to be known as having Native American blood. And the American government has successfully taught people, Native Americans and mixed race Native Americans, to think of ourselves as being different and separate from each other. In other words, you can't be an Indian unless you have a certain card or if you can't prove it or whatever. I can say that because I'm white, I'm black, and I'm Native American. But you only know that because I'm saying that to you. And then the question is, do you believe me? Mm-hmm. See, I was told by my grandmother who I was, but she said, don't tell anyone that you're part Native American, that you're part Cherokee, because it isn't safe. When my grandmother died, she was 100 years old. She knew about the Trail of Tears. She did not want her granddaughter to be killed. For her, it was a reality. So I say this, if you have part Native American blood in you, then you are as harmed by what we've learned tonight, and your children are. Because if they don't know they're part Native American, you have denied them their heritage. Again, it took me a while to acknowledge to anyone, because if you look at me, you see a black woman, to acknowledge that my grandfather was 100% white. Yeah, I didn't want that acknowledgement, not in the history of the world today, because I should be proud to be black, and I am. What I'm saying is that unless America acknowledges its multiracial identity now, we don't have to try to get integration of other races, and that's important. We should be a welcoming community, but we should be welcoming because we are welcoming our own family. You know, I have relatives that come from Barbados. I used to practice St. Patrick's Day until some white person said, you can't be a part Irish. So that denied my white grandfather. Okay? So what I'm saying is we don't have to look to other people. It's a human face. Go home tonight and look in your mirror. Take the time to get what they're doing all over on CNN anyway. Ancestry.com, where the man said, I thought I was German till I looked and found out that I was, now I'm wearing a kilt. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm saying is, tonight, don't think about the other people. Identify the truth about yourself and start telling people the truth about yourself. Because when you do, there is no war. There is no fight. You know, they say we are all one. Well, damn it, you are all one. There is hardly any pure white person on the planet today. Because what's done under the sheets comes out in the light. So if you learn your family history, you'll have no battle. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I really like what she said. And if there's really something that you could put a face on, it's me. I am full Navajo. I am from Arizona. And I am part of a little group called Mission Year here. And I came to Philadelphia. But like I'm currently reading a book called White Man's Gospel. And it talks about how Native Americans were given this thought that Jesus Christ is a white man, you know, and back in Minnesota, like, I think you've heard of this, Cass Lake?
Yes, of course. 1970s,
yeah, like, yeah. You know, like, do you know Craig Smith?
Don't know the name.
Okay, well, I guess he was taken into an assembly and at a school in Cass Lake, and they called all the Native Americans to the auditorium. And then they're like, this guy comes in, and he's like, Jesus Christ is a white man. I cannot accept a white man's religion. So basically, the author, his name is Craig Smith, and he is Chippewa. So he was talking about how, because he's a Christian, and he talks about the reconciliation of the Church of Jesus Christ, you know, like the church as a whole, and Native Americans. You know, like, if one thing that I can say is I really do believe that there should be reconciliation between the churches and Native Americans. For me personally, I can't speak for every single Native American. If there's something that I can speak for is I do believe that true reconciliation can come in the biblical sense, that if it comes from the heart and if it comes from Jesus, it can happen.
I wanted to add just one question into the mix, and this is a conversation that John and I had over email as we were talking about this event. Presented John the idea of a protest against Columbus Day, and when you responded, you know, you kind of pushed a little bit back on that. Like, is this, you know, type of an event, is it really geared towards, you know, symbolic change? Is this just a simply symbolic change that we're shooting for, or are we really aiming for real material change in the lives of flesh and blood living Native people today? So I'd like to put that out as a kind of a discussion question. Do symbolic changes make a difference? Would changing the Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, would that make a difference? Or is that symbolism? Or should our focus be more on kind of what's been emerging here today, like building face-to-face relationships, pursuing justice issues? What is the role of symbolic change in this, in the movement for justice? Any thoughts on that?
Well, just before this meeting, I was talking to Dolores, and she was part of a group who went out to Harrisburg not that long ago, and they persuaded the legislators out there to institute a Native American Day, Indigenous Native Day. It was passed, and it's legal in Pennsylvania. Nobody knows when it is.
Do you know when it is?
No. You know, I heard it's...
How would you find out?
Okay, well, that's something to look into. Like, when did this happen? What is the day? Should this day, can we bring more attention to it?
Yes.
Would that be a satisfactory alternative and keep Columbus Day? Could there be 2 days? Or does one need to be replaced with the other? There's a woman back here. Did you want to, as you had your hand up, did you want to jump into this conversation?
I was just going to
than the gentleman in blue.
Okay.
What he said the other. In our language, we have Indian American. Glisman is the white man, and Skidgin is the Indian. But it doesn't say white man. It just says the other. What if we're not respectful of all the immigrants that come in? Every time something different happens. Mine is Passamaquoddy. I'm an Indian from Maine and Canada, and my father was Irish, and he got a lot of flack for having been Irish, but that's the only side I was taught because it was just not worthy to be taught to be an Indian. I hated that side of me. So that, what do? Cut me in half? I had to learn to speak English, never speak Indian. The only reason I have my language, my grandmother, as soon as my father went to work, we would all talk Indian. The grandmother saved the language. But could the other be that every time we get a new immigrant, we're more respectful of him? I hate Trump putting up a barrier because he doesn't want any new people, any new others to come in. So the other could be anybody. Not just indigenous.
Indigenous. There is an International Indigenous Peoples Day. It was established by the United Nations, and it's August 9th.
I'm Richie. Quaker Voluntary Service. I was at a Continental Confederacy 2 weeks ago that was somewhat orchestrated by Pastor Norwood, where we talked a lot about the Doctrine of Discovery. And there was this one man there, he's of Navajo descent, his name's Mark Charles. I implore you all to check out his work. So he talks about this idea of Columbus Day, and so I went to a public high school in the United States, and we learned about Columbus in a very specific sort of way. And when I first actually learned about the history of Columbus and the sort of genocide maniac that he was not until my senior year of college. I went into a very radical history class where I got to read some Howard Zinn, the Patriots' History of the United States. And so our friend Mark Charles, he talks about how the problem here is that there is a lack of collective memory of who Christopher Columbus is, which stems somewhat from our education system. To get rid of this symbol of Columbus Day is to try to push him out of that situation, try to push him out of that collective memory even. When he is a huge part of it. He is a huge part of our collective memory. We remember him differently, but in terms of reconciliation, in terms of humanity, as some of us were talking about before, we need to maintain that day and actually recognize the trauma that we have experienced. And, to believe for 500 years as a white people that we came over here and discovered this place, for us to dominate and dehumanize the people that were here before that is a traumatic legacy to have. It is a traumatic national identity that we still carry with us to this day. So to get rid of Columbus Day to me doesn't seem like the answer, but rather to try to turn it into like a day of grieving, a day where we can confront this doctrine of discovery, because I think there's a very convincing argument to be made that it was in that doctrine of discovery that white supremacy was kind of instilled in us. A pretty famous Quaker historian by the name of Paul Palmer actually speaks a decent amount about this and about how, we didn't have this sort of idea that we were greater than these others in this sort of proprietal sort of way until those papal bulls of 1452, 1492, and 1493 came out. So, I think that in terms of reconciliation, Columbus Day shouldn't go, but our education and understanding of who he was needs to be reconciled with the facts of the matter. So.
Thank you.
Any response? I mean, that's a really powerful statement. I think anybody like to respond to that?
I don't necessarily have a response to it, but I will share with you that for many indigenous people, it is indeed a day of mourning. It is already recognized for us as a day of mourning. And then as to what we can do to make this change, as a Christian woman, I have to tell you, we need to be praying. We need to pray for each other, that we would recognize that it's okay that there are differences among us. We need to pray for indigenous people as a whole and pray that we're not relegated to. I have to tell you, it makes me so crazy that if I say I'm Native American, there's this kind of look like, well, where's your fringes, man? Where's your feathers? Are you really? That's unbelievable. My children sit in class in New Jersey public schools, or they did. They're much older now. And are told they don't exist. We need to be praying about these things because it is only God's intervention that will bring the reconciliation that we all so desperately need.
Are there any folks just in the last couple of minutes that would like to throw out something else, or could you observe anything that's maybe coalescing in our conversation? Any recommendations for actions?
I just feel it's really important for us to address the myth as being a lie in every venue that we can, and to go to your, you know, to the board meetings, and because it's really important because our children are still learning these lies, and it's important for us to address the education system as well as one another and folks that we meet about the myth and the lie that this has all been perpetuated by.
It can take one person. I was listening to a woman where her son was in school and it was had revisionist history about slavery, in which it was described that Africans were brought here as workers in the agricultural fields. And so it left out the whole concept. Now McGraw-Hill, I think that's the company, is revising its textbooks because one woman pronounced that she would not accept the textbook, and she started sending that information to her friends. And then, of course, now she's on CNN able to say that they have written her a letter saying that the textbook is going to be revised. So we might just think about the fact that the textbooks have to be rewritten.
Because the teachers can only teach what they are given in the textbook, so it needs to be changed.
What goes in the textbook is inherently an act of power.
I was just thinking a lot about the comfort and strength that people derive from myths, and also, like, so thinking about the educator context and you're bringing up things, sometimes people aren't in a space to hear it. I know when a lot of my transformation happened in becoming like pro-decolonization and realizing the lack of truth that was prevalent in my self-image and ancestral wisdom I'd inherited, or lack of wisdom, as the case may be. For me, sticking to what my values are, so like for Quakers, for example, we like to hold up William Penn and his relationship with the indigenous people. And that's a comfortable myth for us. But you look now at what amount of land do indigenous people have in Pennsylvania. Or no, what I really want to say is that the way that myths are still, that we may draw strength from them, but what really should be a stronger force is a desire for truth. And that's where I take refuge. I take pride in a Quaker practice of questioning and of looking at the roots of things. And less so much in the historical predecessors, because they were flawed and they were human, but that striving was a constant.
Well, thank you all for coming. This was a really beautiful conversation, and I hope that this will inspire some of you to write op-ed letters to the Inquirer, maybe articles, but to continue to tell the story. And that's why I was really so grateful for John's presentation, because it was telling the story, and I believe telling the story is inherently an action of justice in itself, giving voice to those who have no voice. Robin, could you just send us off?
Sure. Thank you so much for coming tonight and for the authentic words that were shared, not only from our guest speakers, but from those of you who made comment. One of the things that my elders taught me, the one thing that still rings true, at least as a white male in America, pride goeth before a fall. There's so much pride that's wrapped up into the myths one of which we've heard a lot about here tonight. And I think there is no, for me, a white male, there is no reconciliation until there's deep repentance. And deep repentance requires a rethinking, almost a visceral re-understanding of how I got to where I am and what privilege, white privilege, remains intact that needs to be stripped away. So there's a deep amount of repentance that has to go on before you can get to anything like reconciliation. But I thank all of you for coming tonight. That's my testimony. That's my witness. And I would hope that each one of you will take away from this a measure of inspiration to do whatever work you're already doing from whatever point you are in this undoing, unraveling of the myths that have caused dispossession, that has caused oppression, that continues to cause physical harm and psychological damage to so many people. This is the basic work of people of faith, regardless of what faith, or people of spirit, regardless of what spirit. This is the basic work that needs to be done. And may God help us.